Coming up today, why the UN's biometric database of refugees might be a bad idea. We work out the likelihood of you getting hit on the head by China's out-of-control space station and celebrate International Women's Day. This is episode 359 of the WideUK podcast, your weekly guide to the best of science, tech, ideas, business and design. I'm your host, James Templeton, and joining me are Roland Manthorpe.
Hello.
And Vicky Turk.
Hi.
Facts. Straight to it.
Who wants to go first?
Yeah, who wants to go first?
Well, I have a kind of vaguely International Women's Day related fact.
Okay.
Not about human females, but female monkeys. So I found out recently that bonobos, a type of primate, live some... primatologists think, in matriarchal societies, which is quite interesting because it's very different from chimpanzees, which are notoriously aggressive and live in kind of male-dominated communities. And why it's particularly interesting is because chimps are often used in kind of studies looking at evolution and kind of inferring things about human nature, because obviously they are quite closely related to us in the animal kingdom. So the fact that bonobos maybe live a bit differently might shed some doubt on some of the kind of assumptions we make about human behavior and inherent traits of men and women.
So this International Women's Day, let's all think, what would a bonobo do? is that the lesson?
Maybe. I mean, it's basically saying, you know, some people think that there are inherently male and female traits.
Gotcha.
But when we look at this kind of broader area of scientific research, we see that there is, you know, a widespread of evidence.
Well, related, it's barely related, but wasn't it until the very late 1800s that boys wore pink and girls wore blue, and then they flipped?
Yes,
because red used to be considered a masculine colour, and then you'd kind of do a pale version for babies.
Yeah, so there we go.
So all these stereotypes actually are, you know, not necessarily based in indisputable scientific fact.
Roland?
I learnt that 34% of the streets in the UK with a number 14 don't have a number 13. And in Birmingham, which is, for reasons I don't know, I don't know the reason why, but in Birmingham, 74% of streets with a number 14 don't have a number 13.
So did, at some point, Birmingham have a very, very superstitious urban planner?
I guess that's the reason why.
Must be, mustn't it? And this is madness. I mean, you go to Vegas and you expect it, right? Most casinos, I think every single casino in Vegas has a 12th and a 14th floor. And I stayed on the 13th floor of a Vegas hotel once.
Oh, really? And was it...
Well, it was the 14th floor.
Well, it must have been unlucky because you were there for CES.
Yeah, exactly. No one wins. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yes, I know. So, yeah, and a couple of councils, a few councils, including Lewes and Hertfordshire, have actually banned the use of the number 13 in new developments.
Oh, come on.
Well, so apparently the reason is because people move into a number 13 and then... I think it can actually have like a material effect on the house price. Anyway, so they don't want to live there because they're superstitious. So they get in touch with the local council and they say, look, can I change this to 11A or 12A or whatever? And the council's got so tired of this, they just decided, look, let's just get rid of number 13.
So are you saying to get on the property ladder in London, I should be looking specifically for number 13s? Because there'll be less competition.
There may also be less on offer, though.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
I did like the bit there, Roland, where you thought that 11 came before 13.
Maths.
Well, it's because in the UK we have this thing where on one side of the street it's the odd numbers and on the other side it's the even numbers. So it was a reference to that.
Oh, I see. So you were actually just trying to be clever.
I was actually just being clever, not trying.
This has been great. I learned this week that some roads in Estonia don't have an upper or lower speed limit, but they have a middle limit. So you're not allowed to drive at any less than 25 kilometres an hour or any more than 40 kilometres an hour.
That probably makes a lot of sense, right?
It does, because these are a specific kind of road. So these are ice roads. There's not many of them in Estonia, but there are a few. And there's a danger that between 25 and 40 kilometres an hour, the motion of the car can produce a wave, which is a bit like the... what would you call it, from a ship? A bow? Is it? Yeah. It's the wash
a
that
comes...
Wake? Yeah. Basically, the wave builds up underwater, and the longer you drive at that speed for, the higher the chances that this wave develops, and if it develops too much, it cracks the ice and your car falls in.
Wait, so you mean they have to drive at under 25 kilometres an hour or over 40 kilometres an hour?
Yes.
When do they have to decide? Like, do you have to decide before you get on that bit of road, or can you very quickly speed up?
Well, so the idea is that you can drive for a very short amount of time at those speeds. So you'd go up to 25 and then keep going until you got up to 40. And I guess the distance between 25 and 40 wouldn't be that much. So you'd be all right. You also, you can't drive more than 250 metres. Yeah, sorry, you have to drive 250 metres or more behind the nearest vehicle, again, because it can create a wave, and you're not allowed to wear seatbelts.
Sorry, what? No seatbelts?
No seatbelts, because if the ice cracks, you're not going to want to be going, oh, bugger, I can't undo my sign.
Right.
Dead and cold. Yeah, Estonian ice roads.
I'm not sure if I'd feel that safe going over an Estonian ice road knowing all this.
No, maybe go somewhere a little bit colder where the ice is thicker. Apparently it's totally safe, though, so long as you obey those simple rules. We should remind you again this week that we have a survey. We want to know what you think of the Wired UK podcast, and if you listen to our sister podcast, Upvote. Never heard of it, Roland.
It's great.
Is it?
Please say that in the survey.
Yes, please do. Tell us about...
You've never heard of it?
Yeah.
No, that it's great and that you want more of it, but not so much more that it becomes loads of effort for me.
There you go. So tell us everything that you think and feel about the Wired UK podcast and Upvote. You've got a chance of winning £100 in shopping vouchers. Ooh, shiny prizes. Selfridges, House of Fraser, Liberty, John Lewis, or online with Apple and Amazon. So please do spill all. Tell us what you think, and we'll be making some changes, probably, to the podcast based on what you all have to say. The more people that fill it out, the better. So head to wired.uk/podcast survey. Not wired.co.uk, confusingly. wired.uk/podcast survey, all one word. And tell us what you think. All good?
Yeah.
Let's move on. Our first story this week is about the biometric tracking of refugees. Roland, this is something that most people probably aren't even aware is happening.
No, and it all goes back to the gigantic refugee crisis, which I'm sure that everyone is aware of, and has kind of really hit the world in the last decade or so. And although it hasn't been in the news so much recently, it's still really going on. And obviously this has created massive, massive logistical problems for humanitarian organisations, including UNHCR, the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees, the UN Refugee Agency. And so, in order to resolve a few of their logistical difficulties, they decided to turn to biometric tagging. What did I say there? Tagging. Anyway, biometric registration, which is where you take people's fingerprints and iris scans in this instance. And so every time someone turns up at... one of the kind of the camps where people end up filtering into when there's a humanitarian crisis.
Yeah.
The UN takes their fingerprints, scans their irises, and puts it in a gigantic database, which they call the Biometric Identity Management System.
BIMS.
Exactly.
And on the face of it, this seems like a sensible idea because you need to know where people are coming from, what they're fleeing, who they are, I suppose. You've got an idea of the scale of the problem that you're dealing with. So that's the idea behind this, right?
Yes, exactly. And you're right, from a kind of data collection point of view, it makes a lot of sense. And UNHCR are clearly finding it effective because they've pursued it at great scale. There are, it's estimated, I mean, no one really knows, but it's estimated there are 22.5 million refugees spread across the world. At the moment, 20%. Are in BIMS, this biometric database. 4.4 million adults and children over the age of five. It's in 200 locations across 43 countries, and in a lot of the countries where there are really awful things happening.
Yeah. So this is a vast, vast, vast data set, and it's being managed by an organisation that everyone would agree has good intentions. But.
So there are two kinds of problems. The first set of problems is about managing this stuff, which is really hard. You know, people, even kind of companies that are just dedicated to this kind of issue, to managing these systems, get it wrong. And UNHCR is not one of those kind of companies. And there have been a couple of internal audits that have found worrying security practices and also kind of people, refugees, not really being given, put through the proper process so that they give proper consent for this sort of thing. I mean, it's really hard, you know, if you turn up and you're kind of effectively, or it's suggested to you that you might not get aid or you might not be able to get money out of a bank account because they use it for ATMs. And unless you can hand over your details, then you're probably going to hand over your details, right? But the second set of problems comes when we're dealing with really kind of difficult situations, such as the one that is happening now in Bangladesh, which is where many Rohingya refugees have fled from the persecution in Myanmar.
So this is what the US administration, and I think the UK as well, refers to as ethnic cleansing. So it's a very, very serious situation.
Yes, and the Myanmar government forces have killed a lot of, massacred lots and lots of people, lots and lots of the Rohingya minority in Myanmar. And as a result, lots of people, especially women and children, have fled to Bangladesh, this area called Cox's Bazar.
And Bangladesh has said that it eventually wants to send them back to Myanmar.
And so this is where you start to get the problems. So at the moment, the biometric database system is being used to kind of, let's say, control the movements of the refugees. And this is data which you can really, really, really use to identify someone. Bangladesh wants to send the refugees back to Myanmar, where they're still definitely at risk of further persecution. And they've also said that they want to use their biometric data to do that. And you can see how this is starting to become a really, really difficult issue, in the sense that these people are fleeing on the very basis of their identity because of who they are. You've created a system where you can track their identity without fail. And this is not like names and addresses. This is data that cannot be altered, cannot be changed. And then you're working with a government that kind of just wants to get rid of these people and send them back.
So what does the UN say about this? What's its stance?
The UN say that they need this kind of data to operate the system effectively. They say that they won't share it without anyone kind of inappropriately.
Mm.
But like I say, there have been a few kind of a few issues around this. And I guess you have to wonder whether it really is worth it collecting this data. And it's very interesting to me that Oxfam have put a moratorium on collection of biometric data. They just said, look, we are not capable of doing this. We don't know what the right way of doing it is. I feel like we don't really have an answer, but it's something that people should be talking about and should be more aware of.
What's the alternative? Would it just be that, because obviously a lot of these people fleeing, they don't have documents proving their identity, they have nothing with them, which makes, you know, biometric data seem like a potentially quick and easy way to come up with an identification. But what's the other option? Would it just be that the UN has to help everyone without knowing who they are? I mean, why do they really need to be able to track movements in great detail and track identities in order to provide aid?
So I think that it's just for ease of use. That's sort of my understanding of this. I think also it's one of those things where you can see that it might create a more efficient system doing it this way. And you always get these kind of concerns around fraud and things like that, and people kind of taking aid inappropriately. As far as I'm aware, those concerns are often overblown. But I guess the system,
surely the risk of helping a few extra people is not so much as the risk of, you know, sending people off to persecution.
That's what you might think. Yes, I mean, I should say I haven't been to these camps and reported on this, so I don't really know myself. And I think, no one's saying that the UNHCR aren't operating with the best intentions.
But isn't it, as well, it's sort of part of their remit, right, is to get these refugees back to a home. And I guess you can't really send someone somewhere unless you know who they are and unless you know where they've come from.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And that's kind of how you end up getting into this difficulty where you're sharing the information say with the Myanmar government, which the Bangladeshi authorities have said that they're going to do. I think Bangladeshi authorities have already given lists of at least 8,000 Rohingya refugees to the Myanmar government.
So is there a naivety kind of, here on behalf of the UN that because they're collecting this data with the best of intentions and to ease the process, which is an incredibly complicated one that they're doing, they're presuming that everyone else involved will have good intentions as well.
I guess it's one of those things where as long as everything goes okay, then the system should... It makes sense.
Yeah.
But the trouble is that... I mean, this ultimately relies on software. You know, so like things go wrong. Always. They always go wrong. And the risks are so vast. They're kind of almost like too vast to comprehend. I mean, this is genuinely a life and death matter. And I think it's especially in the humanitarian sector where the power disparities are so great between the people who are operating the system and the people who are part of the system.
Yeah. But why does the UN need to share these details with nation states and authorities at all? Why can't it just keep it to itself?
As far as I understand, it's because the authorities in the particular country are the ones who are often administering the camps. The UN doesn't have the resources to do it all itself.
I see. So it's just part of the administration of these systems. So it wouldn't be a case of the UN in Bangladesh handing those details to the UN in Myanmar. They simply don't have the scale, so they have to give it to the authorities in those countries.
Yeah.
Mm. So what's next?
I don't know. That's a good question. I think it's this kind of when the writer who's been working on this piece kind of approached me about this, I'd never heard of it. It's hardly been written about. It's going on, but it's not kind of understandably, it's not really a big focus of work.
Yeah,
so I'll be very interested to see what how the UN responds to this.
And it's unintended consequences, and I suppose the real pinch point here is what happens to these incredibly, incredibly vulnerable people as they do start to go back to Myanmar. And as you said, if the system works, then it's fine. But there's huge risks here for data that is this unchangeable and this specific to people's identities.
Yeah.
And it kind of goes against the whole idea of being a refugee.
Biometric data is really dodgy like that. It's because it's, you know, a password can always be changed. You can always escape.
Yeah.
You can always leave an address. But biometric data, a leak of that kind, or a hack of that kind, especially when you've got people who really want it, who have very strong interests in getting hold of it, that's extremely worrying.
Yeah. So if you're listening to this podcast on Friday, the day we put it out, then you won't be able to read the story just yet because it's been published on the website on Saturday morning at 7 o'clock UK time. There's an awful lot of detail in there that really help you understand what's at stake here. I really encourage everyone to go and read it. It's a fantastic piece of reporting. Our second story this week is about space junk. So you may have heard this week that China's out-of-control space station, Chang'e 1, is set to come crashing back to Earth sometime between the first week of April, sometime between the end of March and the first week of April, give or take a week. We're not quite sure when. And this is a rare event for such a large piece of space junk or an orbiting satellite or space station to come back down to Earth uncontrolled. And this is the real puzzler here. China lost control of it, so we don't know when and where it's going to come down, which is fun.
Great fun, unless it hits you.
Well, yes. So it weighs 8.5 tons. And what we think we know is there is no probability of it landing above 45 degrees or below 43 degrees. So that counts out Antarctica, the southern tip of South America, and Northern Europe, Canada, most of Siberia, and places above that where so few people live.
Does London count as Northern Europe?
We're just out of the firing line. So the...
Okay.
We can rest easy.
Everyone relax.
So
It's other people.
Well.
Other people's problems.
So there's a thin band around 43 north and 43 south where we think it's most likely to come down. So particularly likely to be hit are northern China, and this shows you how unsure we are. Northern China, the Middle East, central Italy, northern Spain, the northern United States, New Zealand, Tasmania, parts of South America and southern Africa. So we don't really know where it's most likely, where it definitely will hit, but we can kind of have an idea based on how it's descending into the Earth's atmosphere over the coming weeks.
Why don't we know? What makes it? I would have thought its path would be relatively easy to predict.
So its descent is uncontrolled. So in 2016, China announced that it had lost control of this thing, and its fall to Earth was inevitable. So that I think it's called the perigee of its orbit starts to decay, and this basically means that it's coming down to Earth, and as it comes down to Earth, it slows. But depending on the angles at which it hits the atmosphere, that will mean that its speed will change depending on how it breaks up, whereas on a controlled descent, so I think Mir, the Russian space station that preceded the ISS, was brought down in a controlled descent. So they were able to do that nice and safely and dunk it where there was no one. Maybe it came down in the ocean, probably not. Somewhere in northern Siberia, perhaps. But in this case, it could hit a major population area.
And do we know what it will look like when it enters the Earth's atmosphere? Like, is this going to come down in loads of little pieces, or will it be kind of a big chunk of space station?
Again, we're not really sure, and part of this is to do with it's a Chinese project, so there's a little bit of difficulty getting information. So NASA's not really sure, the European Space Agency's not really sure, and China's been keeping vaguely quiet about it. What we do know, so to go back to the odds of being hit by this thing are 1 million times smaller than the odds of winning the US Powerball jackpot, which, according to an organization called the Aerospace Convention, is 1 million times smaller than a 1 in 292 billion chance.
Okay.
So whatever that means.
So don't lose sleep?
Yeah, don't lose sleep, but do lose sleep. No one has ever been hit by a part of a spacecraft, and only one person is known to have ever been hit by a piece of so-called space junk. It was a lady called Lottie Williams in 1997. She was walking through a park in Tulsa, Oklahoma at 4 o'clock in the morning, as you do, when some mesh debris from a second stage Delta rocket hit her on the shoulder.
I'm pretty sure that happened to me one time at 4 in the morning.
Yeah.
Walking through a park.
Definitely the mesh debris. I mean, it only did a minimal harm. So, you know, but what in terms of what it will look like, I think there was a Japanese space lab that came back to Earth maybe in the late 90s, and it basically looked like a spectacular meteor shower. And Chang'e 1 is quite a bit bigger than that. So chances are that when it does come down, we'll have something pretty to look at. The danger is that pieces as large as 100 kilograms, pretty hefty, could make it all the way to Earth.
Okay, that's pretty big.
Yeah, but so much of the Earth is covered in water, probably goes down in the ocean, and so much of the Earth, even in between these bands, is just empty desert and tundra. So chances are, again, it doesn't come down where anyone lives. So we're really playing with incredibly, incredibly small odds, but there's still a chance. And the other thing, even if it doesn't hit you, if you chance upon it, so say it comes down in a park somewhere in a city, you're like, ooh, what's this?
Oh, Fantastic Four. I know about this.
Yeah, it may be carrying a toxic and corrosive rocket fuel called hydrazine, which can give you cancer.
I feel like you keep telling us not to worry and then giving us another reason to worry, James.
It's true. Chances are you'll see something pretty in the sky, but lesser chances are that you could get cancer from a piece of space debris or get conked on the head by the thing.
What I'm hearing is that I should approach it because I've got, like, downside, I could turn into the thing.
Yep.
Upside, Mr. Fantastic, the Invisible Woman, or hopefully I just stayed the Invisible Man. Oh, what's his name again? The fire guy, Johnny Storm. Anyway, the three, basically, chances are awesome.
Where are you going
powers.
With this? Oh, you want superpowers?
Yeah, because when things fall out of the sky and you go up to them and they emit a strange gas, you get superpowers. This is a well-known fact.
I see. Yes. So there we go. Between the end of March and the beginning of April, give or take a week, look up to the sky. Chances are, as we get closer to it, we'll know an awful lot more about where it's going to hit, and then people can start to make plans for a nice evening of artificial stargazing. So there we go. Our third story, less of a story and more of a discussion point. Today we're recording this on Thursday afternoon. International Women's Day is today, but we wanted to kind of distill it down into something that we could be really passionate about, which are people that we believe are really important that are worth highlighting. So we've had a bit of a think over the last couple of days and come up with some names of some people that we feel don't get the attention that they deserve. So Vicky,
I should say, you know, for us, every day is International Women's Day, but International Women's Day on the 8th of March gives us a nice opportunity to step back and think about how things are going. Spoiler alert, no equality yet. Anyway, to celebrate, we basically went out to a bunch of women in the wired world. These are women whose work we really look up to. We think they're doing great stuff. And we asked them to nominate another woman who we may not have heard of, whose work they admire and that they think deserves greater recognition. So we've pulled these together. You can go and see all of the nominations on wired.co.uk. We've got suggestions from people like Susan Fowler.
Jean Liu, the president of Didi Chuqing.
Jean Liu, president of Didi Chuqing. Adwoa Oboa, the model and activist. A whole list of people. And they're just kind of putting forward a woman who they think deserves to be better known. And it's really interesting, actually. There are some people there that I hadn't heard of before and that I will definitely be following in the future.
Sue Black nominated Sue Black.
Yeah,
which is just tremendous.
Sue Black, just to clarify, not herself, but there are two Sue Blacks who are both doing very interesting, very different things in the worlds of tech and science.
So it's Sue Black who specialises in the technique of catching paedophiles based on the markings of their hands.
Yes.
Nominated Sue Black, who was one of the lead campaigners to save Bletchley Park.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
They're both great.
Yeah. What are the chances of two Sue Blacks finding each other and finding a common interest?
There must be others out there, isn't there? I wonder if all Sue Blacks are just doing amazing things.
And they all get together every year to compare notes.
The Sue Black Symposium.
So, Vicky, do you want to go first? Who's your pick?
We thought we'd all select a woman's work to highlight on this day as well. My pick is a woman called Yvonne Hutchinson. And I met her at a recent tech conference and had a really great conversation with her. She was speaking and she gave a talk about diversity and women in tech and basically how companies can create a more diverse and inclusive workplace. She's a founding member of Project Include, which works on these issues. You might know it from Ellen Powell. She is another founding member of that.
Oh, that's what. So Ellen Powell, previously of Reddit, and where was she before Reddit?
Kleiner Perkins.
Yep.
She famously brought a gender discrimination case against them.
Mm.
She works on Project Include, and she also runs a consultancy called ReadySet, which describes itself as a diversity solutions firm and basically helps people make their workforce more diverse, especially in, you know, in tech and in Silicon Valley, where, as we've seen, this is a huge problem.
Yes.
I find her work super interesting and she's got a really good perspective on this stuff. She talks a lot about how more diverse teams actually lead to better decision making and, in particular, more ethical decision making, which I hadn't actually heard of before. And I find this really interesting. It's not an area that's been studied greatly, but there are a few studies out there which suggest that if you have people from diverse backgrounds and with diverse points of view on a team, then they end up making more ethical decisions.
As you might see in a wider society, I suppose, if you have a group of people who are all from the same background, they're more likely to focus on their own interests.
Yeah, I guess, or just agree to each other and not perhaps present a dissenting view, which may lead people to question whether they're taking the right course or not. So I really love what she says on this issue. And basically her mission is that she wants to make tech companies look more like the country they're in terms of demographic makeup. So she does a lot of work in the US and she's like, you know, these tech companies should look like the US, which is not all white and male. It's much more diverse than that. And she emphasizes that it's not just about representation, because representation is meaningless without power. You need people in these leadership roles. And also that the playing field has never been neutral. You know, I think we often forget that in discussions about diversity and inclusion. And especially in the US, she emphasizes the struggle of African Americans who, you know, going back to the history of slavery, there has not been an equal footing in the US labor workforce.
Yeah.
And so she suggests, you know, now is the time to address that with things like pay parity. These are not optional things. These are things that we need to take actual definitive actions to make happen.
And the work that she's pursuing, we're kind of seeing a little bit of it in some of the big Silicon Valley firms that we spend a lot of time talking and writing about. I think the role is it chief diversity officer or things like this? I think Airbnb now has one, maybe Facebook as well.
I'm always a bit skeptical of these kind of things. I think obviously it's a great idea if it gets follow through. I think these kind of initiatives are all very new, so it's impossible to say either way. I don't want to be really down on them, but I think, you know, you really have to hold people's feet to the fire and say, you know, it's not good enough just to pay lip service to diversity or just to say that you're trying to address this issue. You have to show results and you have to experiment with different ways of getting those results, and you have to have very specific goals that you want to reach and specific ways to attain them. Otherwise, it will not happen.
It was in the introduction that you wrote to the piece where we've asked people for their sort of future star nominations. You make a really good point that for 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years, companies like Google and Facebook and Twitter and whoever it may be have been putting out these diversity reports saying, oh, it's terrible, you know, we're, we've only got 16% non-white male employees at executive level, yada, yada, yada. If you take out all the cleaning staff, then in terms of racial diversity, we're just all white or Asian, et cetera, et cetera. And these companies every year, and there's been some slight movement, but for the most part, they're just going, God, no, we're still terrible at
this.
Well,
yeah, I mean, you've heard me complain about this in the office. And so I remember when some of the big companies, and they're not obliged to do this, but a few of the big tech companies, including Google and Facebook and Twitter, I believe, they started putting out about, must have been about 5 years ago, these diversity reports where they break down their employees by gender, by race, just to show kind of where they're at. And I remember the first time they did this, the numbers were obviously terrible, but everyone kind of praised it as this great move. You know, transparency is the first step. Knowing how big the problem is necessary in order to address this.
Yeah.
And I'm just really frustrated that we keep kind of seeing the same thing every year. And I know these issues aren't resolved overnight, but I just feel like I was so full of hope back then, James.
And these are companies with stated missions to connect the world, to make the world a better place, to make humanity more prosperous and successful. You know, they've got huge, ambitious missions. So, you know, you say these things take time, but they're ambitious companies.
Yeah, and some companies are making a really concerted effort and are seeing results. So it can happen. You just genuinely have to make this a priority. And I think that's what's been lacking, really. Lots of people, talk the talk, but it's not on their top priorities.
So, Roland, let's get your name for your, not nomination, your shout out, I guess.
Okay. Oh, well, I just couldn't bring myself to nominate one person, so I nominate two. I know it's pathetic, but
it's very like you.
Yeah. shout out to Mariana Mazzucato, who is an economist and is author of an amazing book called The Entrepreneurial State, which argues that you can't think about innovation seriously without thinking about the role of government. It's a brilliant book, and I think I met her recently, and I just think that it's one of those books that is really changing the way that people think about innovation.
Yep.
And it's fantastic. And the other person, someone that I've never met, but whose books I love, is a woman called Anne Leckie. She's author of some science fiction novels. The first one's called Ancillary Justice. I just love the books. But I really like the fact that she wrote her first book at the age of 47. I think that's extremely cool. And, you know, and as like a long-time science fiction reader, I felt the fact that she managed to bring a different perspective to it that I don't think a male author necessarily would have done.
Mm-hmm.
So in her kind of in her world, people aren't distinguished by gender, and she does kind of really interesting stuff with gender in her books.
I've gone for TV producer Annabelle Jones. So we've all heard of Black Mirror. We've all heard of Charlie Brooker, who's the writer and sort of creator of Black Mirror. But Annabelle Jones has been executive producer on pretty much everything that Brooker's ever made, all the way from back on Dead Set and Newswipe and up to Black Mirror. She's won an International Emmy and a Producers Guild of America award. And oddly, for someone who's so senior and influential in television, she's only ever worked with Charlie Brooker. So she was worked as a producer. So she was at Endemol, kind of in charge of talent recruitment and finding interesting people to come and make television for Endemol. And she met Brooker and they immediately hit it off. And they've had this amazing sort of powerhouse creative relationship ever since. Some 15 years, I think, they've been working together. And what's interesting about her is Charlie Brooker's kind of this very strange personality. And he never really drops his on-screen persona when you see him presenting Newswipe. That's what he's like, seemingly, or at least he puts that forward.
Because you've met him, right?
A couple of times, yeah. And he's very performative. Whereas what's brilliant about Annabelle is that she's, and Brooker has said this about Annabelle Jones, is that she covers everything. So maybe he's left to do the writing, but she's in charge of the creation, the finding the locations, the making sure that the scripts are really up to standard of, you know, she's the boss almost. And you really get that sense of the dynamic between the relationship, that he's kind of off doing his thing and she's really holding it all together. So one of the most influential shows about how we talk about technology and how we view the modern world, it's not just Charlie Brooker. It's Annabelle Jones as well. And she's phenomenal, and it's an amazing career. And they've just done season 5.
Oh, really?
Yeah, they just announced, Netflix has just announced its surprisingly renewed Black Mirror's contract for one more season.
Right. The last one was so good.
It was.
It was, yeah, just amazing.
Yeah, well, and they keep throwing
Annabelle Jones.
Yeah, they keep throwing more money at it as well, which is perhaps unsurprising.
Well, yeah, so those are just three, well, actually four, because Roland had two, names of women across the wide world that we are really loving right now. And, you know, you should let us know whose work we should be more aware of. It's something that we are always looking to discover, people that we might not have heard of yet, especially those that are a bit under the radar or maybe haven't had their big break just yet. Yeah. Let us know.
More diversity.
Tweet at us, email us.
More voices. Do let us know. You can get us all on Twitter. I'm at Jay Temperton. Vicky, you are?
At Vicky Turk, V-I-C-K-I, Turk.
Roland?
At Roald Manthorpe. Although, do people still use... Can't you just search for someone's name on Twitter nowadays?
Yeah. I mean, you could, couldn't you? Yeah. Or you can just get us at Wired UK. And we should remind you before we go, survey, please do take part in the survey.
Chance
winner.
For us.
Vote for us. Yeah, that's not quite how it works, Roland. We want to know what you think about the podcast or about Upvote, this thing that Roland does. You've got a chance of winning 100
vote
quid.
Vote for me.
Vote for Roland. 100 quid in shopping vouchers, Selfridges, House of Fraser, Liberty, John Lewis. But that's not the point. We just want to know what you think of us. So we put together a little survey with lots of questions, spaces for you to type out some more detailed answers. It will only take about 5 minutes, and we really, really do value your feedback. So let us know what you like. Let us know what you don't like, and give us lots of suggestions for things that you'd like to see on the podcast, because we want to make it...
Or hear on the podcast.
Or hear. That makes more sense. We'd like to make it a better audio experience for you. Head to wired.uk/podcast survey. Not co.uk. wired.uk/podcast survey. All one word. And tell us what you think. I'm really hammering home the .uk thing, because my colleague who put together the survey thinks that it's not obvious. So... Andy, that's for you. It's .uk. We'll leave it there for this week, and we won't see them again. I always say see you again. We've never seen you.
Talk into the void again next
week. Yeah, we'll be in your ears again in 1 week. Until then, bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.